an oral history interview of Dr. Robert Feeney at his home in Davis, California. Dr. Feeney was in Antarctica in the early 1960s. The date is the 29th of April, 1997, and the interviewee is Brian Shoemaker. Dr. Feeney, I met you in Antarctica in the 1966, and we flew out to Cape Crozier together, and you were one of the old hands by then. I know there's a background which is quite extensive there. Will you let us know in your own words just how you got started in your profession and how you came to come to the ice, so to speak?
Well, thank you, Brian. My education was primarily at Northwestern University, where I was a major in the field of chemistry, and I also was interested in biology, ended up with more credits than I needed. And then, lo and behold, I was lucky in getting a nice fellowship at Wisconsin in the in-between area of biochemistry. But my work was mainly chemistry. And from there to Harvard Medical School. And there, during World War II, I found that I was interested in joining the Army. I didn't like what I was being related to biological warfare, and which I didn't know I was to be till I got there, so I quit and joined the Army. And then the Army was going to send me to biological warfare work. I asked for overseas duty, ended up in New Guinea and in the Philippines. And then after that, I worked for the government in Berkeley, a big research lab there. And then I was working, I was a protein chemist by then, and I worked on egg white proteins by the government. And my interest then had moved over to blood serum proteins, and that didn't fit my program. And then I was offered a position, University of Nebraska, as professor of chemistry and chair of a division of biological chemistry. And so I went there. And as I had done before, which I didn't waste time describing, like in the Philippines, I had to set up labs, you see, all by myself and my crew. And in Nebraska, I had an old building and had to scrounge a bit. And then we got a new building. And then I found that I had too much administrative duties. And I wanted to do more general work again, and I wanted freedom. And that's really how eventually I got to go to Antarctica, because I got the freedom by coming to Davis in the College of Agriculture with a research appointment in food science and technology because of my egg work.
What year was this?
This when I came to California, this was 1960. And then I was working at the San Diego Zoo, working on birds' eggs. And here I decided from the work I had that there was interesting things in birds from the ocean and from lakes, aquatic birds. And one of the reasons for the interest is that we were using differences in evolution to help us understand how proteins work. It's the same protein from a different bird would have a different structure or function. And so this gave us lots of leads. And for some reason, the egg white protein showed much larger differences than blood proteins. And at that point, I wanted to work on penguin eggs. And I'd had correspondence with a person, his name was Robert Ingram, from the University of Chicago, if I remember. He published papers, and when I wrote him, it was forwarded to the Navy. And that's the last I heard. And then I was sitting next to him at a meeting, and we introduced ourselves and told him I wanted penguin eggs. And he said, well, you can go to Antarctica and get them. And that's how I started going to Antarctica. It was more or less accidental. I thought that with some direction, I could get very good eggs shortly after being laid and break out the egg white, but National Science Foundation told me that they couldn't do it. I'd have to go myself. And I wasn't really that interested because, after all, I'd been deep down under in World War II not too many years before, and liked my work in Davis and had some grants and so forth.
Who provided your grants to go to Antarctica?
My first grant was the Navy transferred money from another professor who had a Navy grant to pay my way down.
ONR?
Yes, ONR. That was maybe an illegal transfer, I don't know. And then so I went to Antarctica and I got my penguin eggs, and it was very lucky.
How did you get them? Did you go to the rookery?
We went out to Cape Crozier.
How did you get there?
We flew out by helicopter, and I was there for just 10 days that time. I got the eggs, broke them out, and brought them back. But while down there, I met a very interesting man. Well, I'd actually had met him before, but I got to be with him, Donald Voslock, who was working on fish. And he showed me fish who were swimming amongst ice crystals. And I wondered, since I had been working on blood proteins, what would their proteins be like? And so we got home, and our hunches, as I said, on the proteins, the egg white were right, and they answered a lot of questions because the penguins were very different from other birds. Mm-hmm. In fact, we found a new protein, which was a major constituent in the penguin egg white, and we gave it the name of, instead of ovalbumin, it was penalbumin. And
my pen?
Penguin.
Oh, penguin, I see. Okay.
Penguin?
Albumin.
Yeah.
Right.
Penalbumin.
Right.
And then the following year, when we went down, I decided to look at some of the fish, and I met a young person who was a technician working with Don Vosag, Art DeVries. And we had a large program that year, picking up over 500 eggs, and also got fish blood, got some fish muscle, too. And so then we were off.
Can we back up a little?
Yes, of course.
Your first year there, you went out to an area which hadn't been visited until just a few years before, since Scott's expedition was out there. And a book written about it,
right,
called The Worst Journey in the World. Did you suffer any of the hardships that these people did?
None whatsoever.
Well, what did you live in? What kind of quarters?
Well, we lived in a little tent hut. I guess it's...
Quonset?
I think you call it a Quonset hut. Mm-hmm. It was a small
James,
one.
James Way?
James Way.
James Way hut.
James Way tent. It didn't have boards on it. Oh yeah, we had some incidents. We had a bad fire in the tent. We had to carry things outside, and things blew away the back, and the boards almost knocked us over. And some of the usual incidents, but nothing serious.
Did you get emperor eggs?
No, I just got Adelie eggs that year. It was in the second year we got some emperor eggs.
Okay, these that's eggs the year you came back to work with fish.
With mainly eggs, but some fish.
Which year was this now?
We started in 1964.
The second trip?
The second trip was 65.
I see.
And this time I brought two men with me. And this was Herman Miller and Dick Allison. And everything went fine. We got lots of... that was a little tougher because, you see, we got all these eggs and you have to mark the eggs and then you have to pick them up within about 6 hours regardless of the weather. And we had to work on a rookery, on colonies at the other end of the rookery at Cape Crozier. So we had a lot of bad weather work. And we got a lot of frostbitten and so forth, but no serious problem. Either the first or second year, we had to evacuate the tent and go down and lie down further on the hill because we thought things were going to blow away. And there was some emergency equipment down there. There was no real problem. Nothing like what Scott had. And
you're aware that that hut did blow away. Eventually.
Yeah, I know. I heard about it. So then we went down. I missed 1 year, but over a period of 7 years, we had programs. And I went 6 of those 7 years. And I usually bring students down, and I try to train them a bit. And when we got to New Zealand, I try to have them climb over a few mountains a little bit to get them toughened up, and it all worked out well. I don't know exactly how many, maybe about 20 or 25 different people went with me over the years. And but we moved into the fish work, and then Art DeVries came and did a postdoc with us for 3 years. And we were already working on the blood and looking at the antifreeze proteins, but that was his PhD thesis, and we published together on it. And so I figure I had good success in Antarctica, and I base it on two things, or maybe three things. One was the fact that I'd had a lot of experiences in working under poor conditions. When I went to graduate school in Wisconsin, it was in an old building. And I had to help build a lab. When I got to Harvard, the war started, and I had to build some more stuff. And then in the Philippines, we had to make equipment. And then probably the biggest thing was leaving my job in Nebraska in order to have freedom and come to Davis. And so then I was able to do this outside work without any problems. And one of the last things was the proximity of Travis Air Base.
Were you...
Made a big difference.
Were you teaching here at the time?
Yes.
And doing other research?
Yes, I was working on proteins. And my main interest in proteins was structure versus function. And we used evolution as a way of learning these things. And then look at the structure of the different proteins. And see, in other words, we get the same protein like what we call transferrin from blood serum. And we get it from one egg of species and then from another species. And it'd be the same protein but have different properties. From that, we could help understand how they function. The transferrin bind iron. And so we use this as a technique, and the penguin eggs paid off. The fish work became this special subject in antifreeze proteins. They have a special function in their blood serum of preventing the blood from freezing. And this is done by putting in a special protein which does not affect the osmotic pressure.
This is the glycoprotein?
The glycoprotein. And this work has been carried on since that time. The egg work was continued. up till about 1982, 83.
This was people you sent down after your time on the ice?
No, no, these were other people getting doctorate degrees at Davis.
They went to Antarctica?
Not in 1982. Mm-hmm. We just had one visit, one eighth visit was done by Professor Yin Ye, and who was a physicist at Davis, who is a physicist at Davis, and one of my graduate students went down in, I believe, 83. I have to check on the date. So then we moved north, and actually from a former student of mine from Nebraska, a PhD in chemistry, was now a major professor at Bergen, Norway, and he invited me.
What's his name?
I can't think of his name at the moment.
You'll think about it.
Yeah, you knocked me off. The poor fellow died, he invited me to come there as a visiting professor, and let me do work on their rather famous research ship, the Geo Stars. And I worked on the stars for the first time for 4.5 weeks with one of my colleagues, David Suga. We went up with the Russian ships up where they, at that time nobody went.
Where did you go?
Well, we went up alongside of Novaya Zemlya.
You see? And this was which year?
This was 1977, I believe. Mm-hmm. And that was quite a trip.
That was with the Russians now?
We were on the Norwegian ship.
Okay, the Norwegian ship's the 77.
But we had a Russian ship that we had to have as a co-ship.
I understand.
Because that's where the Russians used to do rocket practice.
Yes.
We didn't want to go there without somebody with you.
Did you see any nuclear dumping then?
No. No, I didn't see anything like that at all. It was a rough trip, and it was terribly rough. And the Geo SARS was a ship built, trawled, and had a lot of equipment on it. So as soon as they got in a little bit of ice, they'd run to get out. And the ship would rock forward and sideways, but it wouldn't roll over. I don't think it would roll over. But it was like a comeback. It was a rough ride. But we got fish that had the similar protein as in Antarctica.
I see.
And so that was a real good time for us. And then we actually had three more trips on the ship. I went up, but I never went out. My colleague, David Suga, who was with me, went back with a student, and then another student. He went up again at the courtesy of the Norwegians, no charge, free. And they were very nice. And from there, the Norwegian work stopped. National Science Foundation didn't like my putting in a project to where we would cooperate with the Norwegians. And the word I got was that they didn't want to help the Norwegians. And actually, I was helping the Norwegians, but in exchange, they gave us all free passage. And we were going to have two people on the ship and winter over and get stuck in the ice on one. But NSF said they didn't like that.
Who made that decision at NSF?
Well, I don't know whether it's right to say, because I really don't know.
George Lanham? Mm-hmm. Was he involved?
Yes, he was involved. Then I was invited to go up to St. John's, Newfoundland, and as a visiting professor, and they became interested in it, and we did some work with them, have a paper with them. Since then, they've gotten in the business. They now have a company that manufactures antifreeze proteins by having fishermen up in Hudson Bay, northern part, and they're making it for sale.
What do they use it for?
Research, mainly, now. We'll talk about that a little later. And there, I had a student who's, I was on his committee here, who was at Anchorage, Alaska, and he helped us send one of my students up to Alaska, and where we got some fish blood, which had the antifreeze in.
Where in Alaska?
You know, my mind is...
North Slope?
Who?
North of the Arctic Circle?
Yeah, just north.
Just north.
Over on
off
the ocean.
Nome?
No, north.
Wales? Cape Wales?
No. Okay, I'll remember. I didn't go myself.
Chukchi Sea?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't go myself.
North of Bering Straits.
Actually, they then picked up some blood for us. You have to be very careful about these things. You can't have people do you favors and get bad stuff. And then I was invited to be a 90-day all-university professor in Japan. And my wife and I went, and then I learned that they had a sea ice research station at the northern end of Hokkaido, and it gets very cold there, and there's a fish called komai, fish under the ice, and that this should have the antifreeze. So we spent about half our time up in Sapporo, and with help from the Low Temperature Research Institute, we got komai blood, and a couple of times.
Who was your counterpart over there?
There was no counterpart. It was
The one with the Japanese Polar Institute.
My counterpart was in the biochemistry department by Professor Chino, but his friend was in the Low Temperature Institute, and I'll find his name for you. He arranged the visits, but my counterpart was not a fish person. And so we were lucky, and we got some more fish blood from them. I suppose I have to say that it was a lot easier being an independent professor and not having to deal with the National Science Foundation, because I dealt with friends and people in Norway, Newfoundland, Alaska, and Japan. It was a lot less grant writing, no grant writing, no ifs nor ands, just straightforward over the counter.
How about your funding? Your first year, I know you said the Navy funded your research in Antarctica.
The Navy just funded my trip.
Just the trip. How about you went 7 years, though?
The National Science Foundation funded me.
After the Navy,
after the first initial year.
Did they fund the science as well as the logistics, or?
Yes, they funded the science, but you have to realize you have a protein lab going, and a lot of the laboratory was built by the Public Health Service, the National Institutes of Health.
Which laboratory?
My laboratory.
Here?
My laboratory in Davis.
Yes.
Was built by the National Institutes of Health, and the heavy funding came from then. And then after 1971, my last trip down, and including our trip down in 82 or 83, all they paid for then was going and back. All the funding came from the National Institutes of Health. And they funded work on the Pettiwood eggs, but mainly on the fish work. NSF gave me no funding after that. It must have been at least $500,000 from the National Institutes of Health, probably more. I've been lucky in having this program and being able to continue to be a protein chemist. I'm not a marine biologist. I'm meeting a lot of interesting people. And it all started by accident. And having this correspondence with this very nice man from the Navy. There was an interesting occurrence at the end, after my program with NSF was done. I was on their, I guess it was the National Academy Committee on Polar Medicine. I was on that committee for about 3 years. But then I was out of that and off the program. Do you want something about this lunch?
Sure, yes.
Okay, you want to mention names?
Yes.
Okay, I had lunch with a very fine person and a good friend of mine at that time, Ken Moten. And I could buy his lunch because I no longer was a grantee. And I told him I'd been wanting to buy his lunch for many years. And while at lunch, he says, "Bob, where did you get all the drag with the Navy?" I said, "I never had any drag with the Navy that I know of." He said, "Oh, yes, you did." So from that, I concluded that since they gave me such nice support and liked me, it wasn't because they liked me, it was because they were afraid of me. And I still believe that in part. That happened because of my friend who I sat next to at the meeting and shook hands with him and made arrangements. And he wrote a letter to the National Science Foundation asking if they'd help me.
Your friend was Admiral Black?
No. There again, I'm running out of names. Bob was his name. I have to think of it. Then Admiral Black was after I'd been down to Antarctica the first year, I was back with the Navy visiting my friend, and he called up, he made arrangements for Admiral Black to come down and meet me. And we had, if I remember, we talked and had coffee together, and that's all I knew about it, but he was interested in the work. And I guess because there isn't a request, and somehow they thought I was an important person that the Navy was helping in it. Wasn't anything like that at all. It was just that this man was a very nice man.
Had you read Cherry Garrard's book before your first trip down there?
No.
You'd been out to Cape Crozier and then read the book.
That's right. I didn't know where Cape Crozier was. I didn't know anything.
When you went back, did you find the hut?
Yes. But which hut do you mean?
The hut that they had in 1912.
No, never did. No.
You did some work in on penguins down there in the 66. You
yes.
had some emperor penguins in McMurdo. What was that work for?
Well, the emperor penguin. By the way, the emperor penguin eggs were not fresh eggs. They were eggs which had dropped into cracks in the winter when they were laid and they were frozen. And we had to be very careful in examining with great care so there was no microbial growth in them. So those were, that's how we got those eggs. And that was for the same program as the Adelie eggs. We were using evolutionary differences to help us understand the protein properties.
I see.
See, there's about 8 proteins in egg white that you can get out that have biological function. And so we were working with 4 or 5 of those. And Now then, since that time, we worked with, we got eggs from the Royal, and we got two other species, fairy penguins, and one other species, which one of my students got from New Zealand. Went down to New Zealand and got them. I reiterate that for this egg work, you must be very careful to have good material. And so I tried to maintain myself as a protein chemist, tried to learn about the polar areas, and it's been a lot of fun. Had a lot of nice trips, met a lot of nice people, and since then I've done an awful lot of reading on the subject, and have become kind of, in fact, as you know, I have a book about ready to come out on the subject.
You wrote a book back in the 60s called Professor on Ice. Can you tell me about that?
Well, that was a book at the end of my time, mainly for my students. Kind of a diary, more or less, you might say. Not a very good book. It was actually
quite humorous.
Well, yeah. But it was published, that book was kind of like a diary. It was actually, the book was helped by the crew from Freeman Press in San Francisco, whom I had published another book on chemistry. And they knew me, and they helped with me, and for some pay, they helped put it together. But it's a private publication. And but now my book is on my hobby of food and nutrition in polar explorations.
Yes, your book is, I think, very important in helping to understand what made some expeditions successful and some didn't.
Well, you have been very, very helpful in going over the book for me and made a number of very valuable points, which I have used. The book is finally coming out. It's caused some trouble because I have two publishers, which is unusual, and neither one of them have done this before. It's being published by the University of Alaska Press, jointly with the American Chemical Society. So I guess that's not an ending to the story, but it shows the more or less me, two very different sides of me, I guess. Alaska and the strictly American Chemical Society, the Scientific Society.
Well, you're covering expeditions in there. Can you give us some idea, say, on some of the expeditions that had a hard time, like, say, Scott's? What problems did he have, nutritionally speaking, that worked against him?
Well, giving a broader comment, one of the main aspects of the book is that most of the food nutritional problems, a good share of them were people caused. And some of them, particularly in the north areas, were the result of people in London that didn't know anything about the Arctic, making decisions and buying foods and the like. And the British government set up old Navy ships and set up a Navy captain that was very good fighting the French, but not very good in the Arctic.
Who was this?
And I don't remember the names now. It's in my book, a couple of them. But there's that idea. And they sent up these enormous numbers of men on ships, hundreds of men at one time, and on these old ships. And also the people on the ships, not adopting the Eskimo customs, trying to live like they did back in London. Many problems like that. Now, in the case of Scott, I have rather extreme feelings there, I guess. Compared to Amundsen, Amundsen was tough and straightforward and knew exactly what he wanted to do and didn't have any compunctions as to getting in there and getting out quick. And also he had the experiences of the North. Scott didn't. And they use different clothing, and the Norwegians had a one-piece outfit, and Scots had a detachable head and piece, and Scott was made at least two bad errors. One was he didn't use dogs just for part way up, and secondly, he increased his group for the last dash to the pole from 4 to 5, and he maintained the food for 4, and these were two bad errors, I believe.
How about in food selection? Did he have any problems due to lack of proper nutrition?
Yes. From what I could read, Amundsen fed his people pretty raw seal meat before they left, and Scott cooked his meat in the British fraction, pretty well done. And also, people think that there was a difference, important difference in the biscuits that, of course, they bring with them, rather high quantities, that the Norwegians were cooked in the Norwegian way, had yeast, and the British had baking powder.
What significance of that?
Well, the significance is that yeast contain a lot of B vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another possibility. But probably the two biggest things was not using dogs to do man hauling, and secondly, increasing his group from 4 to 5.
Amundsen used his dogs as
feed
fodder,
dog.
Too.
Feed dogs and feed them.
They ate fresh dog meat.
The dogs ate dogs and the men ate dogs.
Is there vitamin C in dog meat?
Yeah, there's vitamin C in dog meat. Yeah.
Dogs produce vitamin C.
Dogs produce some vitamin C. They're not as good as a rat, but they make vitamin C, yeah.
So basically Amundsen had a source of vitamin C.
He started off, well, according to the available data, if you're reasonably well off in vitamin C, and then go on a vitamin C free or very deficient diet, it takes about 90 days. And but Amundsen had his people in a good vitamin C status before they left, and then he had it all the way along.
And Scott didn't have it good
Scott
before
did
he left.
Not. Scott did not have it, but Scott's vitamin C was poor.
So he didn't have a good foundation.
Well, they did eat some ponies, you know, mm-hmm. some of that, but that didn't go. And the other one, of course, was ponies. Ponies can't curl up in the snow like dogs, and ponies have to have pony food.
I switched to the Arctic. Did you investigate the Greeley expedition?
Yes, I wrote on
they
the Greeley
tremendous
expedition.
Nutritional deficiencies.
Well, this is different though. This was due to having missed the ship that was supposed to come to get them. And the weather changed and the ship had to leave. And then the same old problem of not knowing how much of their stuff to haul with them when they left, when they moved, to try to move out. And then there were people problems amongst the group. There was some cannibalism, probably. And but Greeley did a marvelous job, most likely. I feel deserved a lot of credit for holding the group together. They were in extremely bad shape when they were rescued. Just another few weeks, they might have all died. But they did learn how to get some of the lichens and eat them. But they got so weak that they couldn't gather them. But there were people problems there. They had to shoot somebody. And that wasn't for cannibalism. That was for stealing, as happened to people when they're under duress. And so you go back again to the people problems of it all. Scott's problem were, and also Scott's doctor was a, his medical advice was not as good as it might have been. They believed in the putrefaction idea, that scurvy could be caused by meat that was spoiled, which of course is wrong. And so Scott went to great extreme to make everything shipshape, you might say. Everything had to be cleansed and cleaned and so forth to prevent scurvy. And that wasn't the prevention for scurvy at all. Maybe it would have been better to have been dirty, had a lot of rats around, let the rats synthesize vitamin C and eat them.
How do you account for the fact that Cook in 1772, in the first trip to the Antarctic, and later Ross, who discovered the Ross Sea, had no deaths from scurvy?
You mean Cook to the Arctic? You mean Cook to the Antarctic?
Cook to the Antarctic, yeah. And then later Ross,
yeah, right.
In the 1840s. Neither had deaths due to scurvy. In fact, okay. Ross only had one death in this whole expedition.
Now you're running into the problems of how many men on a ship. And the problems with big ships apparently were that at that time, if you stop at an island, how much fresh food can you get for 300 men in a short visit?
But Scott didn't have 300 men.
Pardon?
Scott didn't have 300 men.
I'm sorry, I'm confused by Scott.
Okay, before Scott.
We're not talking about Scott. We're talking about way back when.
Okay, but the thing is, Scott didn't have a good handle on scurvy. He didn't understand it. But Cook did before him.
No, okay.
And so did Ross.
Wait a minute. You see, there was a British piece of research indicating that the lemon juice would alleviate scurvy, but it didn't show that it could prevent it. It was a therapeutic, not a prophylaxis. You don't really use the word prophylaxis for vitamins, but it's there. And this was caused a lot of people did not accept it. And so this was argued for many years, particularly in the Navy. But they did tend to support it. Many of the ship's captains did. And the word went out that the sailors should be given lime juice. Now that was a mistake, because some of the Portuguese or Spanish names for lemons are limonene. And so they thought they were, and limes have about half the vitamin C that lemons have. So when you feed a limited amount of limes, you're not getting that much vitamin C. So there were times when they gave limes and the men still got some scurvy. So there were problems there. And then there were the two theories developed by very good scientists in England that one had to do with let's talk just about the main one, which was that anti-scorbutics were acids. And so they ran an experiment at one time when they fed compounds that had citric acid in them, and they fed it with the lemon juice so that it tasted well, and it worked as an anti-scorbutic. And they said it was the acids they added, not the lemon juice that they gave the men, so the men would like it. So that acids were good. And that was wrong. It wasn't the acids at all. It was ascorbic acid is an acid, but it's not a general acid. So they actually fed the men hydrochloric acid sometimes.
Hmm.
Or, and the other one was that about that time, they had what they called fixed air, and which was carbon dioxide, could be fixed into water to make carbonated water. And so fixed air and acid, since that makes carbonic acid, that this was then given to men. So on ships, they made carbonated water, and the men were forced to drink carbonated water, which did not have any effect, had no effect whatsoever. So for many years, and then there was this putrefaction theory came in. And that was the putrefaction theory that Scott still believed in.
I see.
Working. Okay, good.
Well,
on the nutritional end, again, people caused a lot of it. People's attitudes, their opinions. People have to have strong opinions to survive, you know. And when I look at Amundsen, see, Amundsen's trip down, he had everything planned. I can't remember the exact numbers, but he had like 125 dogs going in. And he figured he'd have like 22 or something coming out, and he was one off when he came out. And not only that, he left caches of food. He had a lot more food than he needed.
And he gained weight.
And he got along just fine, right? And the Scott was a deplorable situation. One other thing with Scott was that it has been stated, in fact it's been written by some of the Arctic explorers, and I don't remember the name now, could have been Perry, P-E-A-R-Y, but men who are small, you don't want big men. You want men that don't need a lot of food and are strong and tough and don't need to carry a lot with them. And Scott had at least one man, member of his crew, who was a very large man. And he complained that he was big and didn't have enough to eat, but he got the same amount, which was wrong. You can't have a man who's 30-40% bigger than others, and he needs more food. And at least he's accustomed to it, and it's not just the amount of work, he takes time to adjust to it. You can't just put him in and cut down his diet. But So people problems, again, people's opinions all the way through, you see these things. But if you look back at the history of nutrition, the history of scurvy, you can see where when one or two or three of the fine scientists in England said fixed air was important, another one said acids are important. And so what's the Navy going to do, you see, except follow these guys? And then, of course, another problem was when they did have lemon juice, the men might not take it. And on at least one voyage, the doctor aboard saw that each man had to come and he had to show that he drank it. That's the only way it could really be done. And we have the same thing now with drugs for different diseases, where people won't take their drugs and cause problems. So that was another problem. That was another reason why some of the data that came back on the efficacy of lemon juice didn't fit, because the lemon juice was aboard and men got scurvy. The reason they got scurvy, they didn't take the lemon juice. So then what you do is count heads. How many scurvy did you get? And on the early trip, I think we got mixed up when talking about some of the early South Seas people. We didn't finish that. On those voyages, the main thing they did was stop at enough islands and got enough fresh fruits. And they learned how to make tea from certain leaves, which have high vitamin C. And they did the main thing was eating fresh fruits, making stock. But a negative side was that sometimes you pull up to an island and 300 or 400 men aboard, they run down, they run ashore, and in a short order there isn't any good fruit left. And that was bad. And then there were problems, you see, with supply ships. There were problems with when they would set off on an expedition, that the bureaucracy would have them make other stops. And they'd have to go to places where there was no food available because they were ordered to. And that caused problems. So, in fact, one of those voyages set back the idea of lemon juice being important because they were so successful. Mm-hmm. So why do you need lemon juice when these fellows went down and had very little scurvy?
Yeah, I understand.
So that was a negative thing.
Well, after your Antarctic experiences, you've taught some polar courses here at Davis. How successful were they, and what was the genesis?
Well, that was because of my interest, my hobby in this area. I'm not a nutritionist, it just kind of rubbed off on me. But I taught a course for 3 years on the subject of the book, The Role of Food and Nutrition in Polar Exploration. In fact, you were one of the people that so nicely gave a lecture for me. Not a lecture, it was actually a 2.5-hour program. And the interesting thing about this was, again, I will interlope here, whether it was my fault, the way I presented things or not, I probably influenced it somewhat, was that like with 15 students, which was the limit we could take, that maybe all but one or two were more interested in the people end of things and what happened than they were the food and nutrition. They got the pitch. And one man last year went off with totally, entirely different thing and got off on waiters. Problems of waiters and difficulties and things. He became very interested in it. And nothing to do with explorations per se, but he saw the difficulties involved. And so that I would say that the course under my direction, I guess, gravitated perhaps in my ideas, I don't know.
Did you have them write papers?
Yes. What we did was this. I gave two of the 2-hour programs, and then I had two guests. You were one, and the other was a MD nutritionist from the campus, who is a, have to use a good word here, he's a devotee is the best word. That's not a strong enough word. He's way out yonder, let's say, on the importance of fat in the diet. And he's experimented on himself by riding a bicycle up in Oregon. And he had a program. And he was also an expert on making caves out of snow. He made snow caves and so forth. And they liked that a lot. But the other six periods were the students gave talks for 15 or 20 minutes, 20 minutes, and then they had to write a little paper on it. And so they were graded on their participation, their talk, and their term paper. And they all wrote pretty good papers. In fact, I learned from some of the papers.
Good. Well, you've had a long career. You were there when NSF was just getting started in the polar business. You observed from afar the evolution of the U.S. program in Antarctica. Are there any unique things that you've seen happen and possible directions they could have taken or should have taken that might have made the program different?
Well, that's a tough question. Remember, I was accused by a very good friend. I shouldn't say accused because I think they generally thought it, that I had a love fest with the Navy. And so they had to be nice to me. that's funny. And one of the problems with the older problems with the National Science Foundation's handling of grants was that they could help govern who the reviewers of the grants would be, rather than having a committee. Now I was on ONR's committee for a while, and they had a committee, and the committee looked over some of the projects. But there, I know they went out to people, and then they came back, and head of the particular program then made the decision. Of course, there's always decisions made, but the first decision into the merit of it would be better done by a committee of scientists rather than have the flow. The flow would come back to a committee like in NIH, and they would make recommendations, and then maybe higher up could rearrange things a bit. But they didn't rearrange things too often, but some. And but NSF at that time had a lot of power. And how much power, I don't really know. I'm not a very good politician.
Did Denny, the scientists, to be delicate, did they have to be careful of what they said in their papers for political purposes, so if they wanted to continue their research down there? Have you heard of people being...
Not in my line of work.
How about geology?
I don't know enough about that. And in my line of work, I don't know of anything mm-hmm. like it. I know that the sometimes recommendations for things which might mean less participation by NSF was frowned upon.
They wanted to be in the center of all research.
I had one case of my own, but I'd rather not talk about it, because I felt I got in bad graces because I...
Did you know Bert Crary?
Yes, I did not know him too well, but I knew him. And he was the chief officer, wasn't he? He was over Llano.
Yes, he was operations officer.
Yeah, for about 3 years of my program, I think. 2 or 3 years, yeah. I knew Tom Jones. And I met Tom Jones just after I cut my foot on a beer can top at Waikiki. He was walking on the beach, and so was I. I cut my foot and looked up, and there was Tom Jones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You knew who he was then?
Or? Yeah, I knew who he was. You know, he didn't know me, of course, but I knew who he was. Yeah.
How about Larry Gould? Did you meet him?
Oh, I met Larry Gould. I love Larry Gould.
How did you meet Larry Gould?
Well, I met Larry Gould in Antarctica 2 times. I met him there once, and I met him twice. And he corresponded with me, and he was a very nice man. I was a little bit disappointed a few months before he died when I wrote NSF and asked about Larry Gould, something other than nobody. He didn't know much about him. And he's still alive, but he was a great, as far as I was concerned, from what I heard in his books, he was a very fine man. Very fine Antarctican. You agree, I hope.
Oh, from what I know about him, yes. Everyone I know who's ever met him eulogizes him.
Yeah.
I've never met anyone to say a negative thing about Larry Gould.
Yeah, he's very fine.
And I had the honor to do his eulogy in the Polar Times. That was being done by Walter Sullivan.
Oh, yeah.
Who got sick and died in the process.
Oh, really? Oh, I remember that article.
Walter, from his hospital bed before he died, reviewed what I wrote. But I had some fine support from both the University of Arizona, where Larry had an equally good reputation as he did at...
Have you seen his republished book put out by...
Gold? Yeah. I have his original book.
But it's been republished, you see.
Have they added new photographs or something? Or
I think so. I've got a copy of it. I'll show you afterwards. Yeah. Sitting right over there.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Well, I think you're kind of milking it a little bit.
We're milking a little thing. But But success I had was due to the experiences I'd had in depression, working in labs where I had to build things. And even at Harvard, I got there and was starting some chemistry work that they hadn't done. And the war hit, and I had to improvise. And then in the Philippines, I had to run a lab where I... Well, actually, we were in the bootlegging business of making gin to sell to the ordnance people to get equipment. So I was pretty well, I was ready for Antarctica, you might say. And the other thing was the decision to leave administration from Nebraska and take a little different job, sort of a across-the-board job between agriculture and the medical school, where I was a professor and had freedom. That allowed me to do all these things. Hadn't been for that, if I stayed in Nebraska, I could never have done it.
Well, good. I think we'll terminate here. And this has been an interview with Dr. Robert Feeney at his home. And today's the 29th of April, 1997, in the evening. A very rewarding period of time. Well, thank you, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Feeney. That's the nature of oral history, is we prod, but we don't tug for answers, for a preconceived idea, which reporters do. We try and push and rather than tug, really. So thank you very much. He's working on, and again, this is